empirical evidence. The whole argument between science and Christianity seems to come down to that very often. Faith has no evidence, science has tons of evidence, and this creates all kinds of misunderstandings. And I think the argument between Christianity and science ought to be pushed down to the epistemological level. In other words, we have different ways of getting at truth, and there are different kinds of evidence, and so on and so on. So that's where the argument really needs to be, I think. In my presentation, I want to keep it a little bit on a popular level. And so let's start by defining and reminding ourselves what empirical evidence is all about. Empirical evidence is presumably about the evidence of experience. So it's evidence that we gather by our senses. We see something, we hear something, smell, taste, touch, and so on and so on. That's empirical evidence. Pure reason, on the other hand, is something that we might do in mathematics and philosophy and some branches of theology. And only here can we really talk of proof, like our guest was saying this morning. So there's empirical evidence, there's straight rationalism, I suppose, and you might say there's mysticism too, where you arrive suddenly at truth in some unmediated way, at some realization of some grand new thing in your mind. So besides, I just want to remind you of this, that besides the requirement for empirical evidence in science, the scientific method also cares about experimentation, of course, repeatability, uncontestability. And experimentation is a way to generate empirical evidence in a repeatable fashion. Empirical evidence is always the kind of evidence that can be seen or heard or whatever. Of course, these powers of observation are highly enhanced by such things as hadron colliders or one-way glass or X-ray technology for reading the Dead Sea Scrolls and so on and so on. But the basic thing still is about what you can see or hear and so on and so on. Before going on, I just want to make this point that historical evidence is empirical, but it's inherently singular and non-repeatable. That's something we have to be very aware of, I think. And so it has to be, historical evidence has to be treated according to its own rules. So let's get to the point then. Jesus and his world, what was the interest, if any, in empirical evidence? I have eight short theses. Martin Luther had 95. I only have eight, but that'll do for now, I think. So, number one, in the world of Jesus, there is widespread use of empirical observational language. So, if you think about it, everything we know about Jesus' ministry was very public. It was open for people to see and to hear, and the reports of it are all based on observation. The Gospel of Mark, for example, is a very short little book, about 24 pages in the average English translation, and the word cluster see, seeing, and saw occurs about 65 times, and the word cluster hear, hearing, and heard occurs about 40 times, touch and touch occur about 11 times, know and knowing occur 23 times. So, in the book of Mark, about six times on every page, you have some reference to empirical evidence and to the business of knowing. So, this is pretty pretty interesting for our topic. If you just want to, lots of people think that Jesus was all about mysticism and so on. And if you just want to think about some of the issues in the life of Jesus that might have been mystical, you might think of demon possession, for example. Or you might think about various ancient figures appearing at various times. Or you might think of the ascension of Jesus itself. These maybe have some mystical qualities to them. But the way they're reported in the New Testament is all strictly observational, empirical language that's used to report them. So that's number two. That's the first point, that there is widespread use of empirical language and observational language. Secondly, in the world, birth of Jesus, there is strong demand for explicitly empirical evidence to support truth claims. So in the Gospels, the Jews often demanded signs from Jesus, signs. A sign was an event. A sign was usually a historical event, sometimes but not always a miraculous event, but one that could be taken as empirical evidence in support of some kind of a truth claim that Jesus or others were making. The demand for a sign is a demand for empirical evidence. It's noteworthy that this language of signs is exclusively used, or almost exclusively used, in a Jewish context. So the Jews came by their interest in signs and evidence as a result of the deepest principles of their faith. From the very beginning, Jewish belief is rooted in history, in stuff that happens. And most of the literature of the Old Testament is historical in nature. The prophetic and wisdom literature is at least indirectly historical. And so the Jews come by this interest in signs or empirical evidence very understandably. And overall, it's both the glory and the agony, what we might say, of Jewish and the Christian faith, that they're deeply rooted in history. This fact means that the truth claims are rightly expected to be supportable by empirical evidence. So it's not surprising to find it here in fairly large measure. Thirdly, in the world of Jesus, there's a high degree of contestability of truth claims. Jesus himself is presented as a very highly controversial figure throughout his public ministry, and he's constantly in conflict and being checked by his family, his disciples, the Jerusalem establishment, and the Roman authorities. The crucifixion itself is strong evidence of just how contestable Jesus' truth claims were and how contested they were. In Mark, essentially every event reported about Jesus and the disciples is contestable and is in fact contested. In Mark 2 alone, we have these questions. Why does this man speak like this? Who can forgive sins but God alone? Why do you ask these questions? Which is easier, this or that? Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why did John's disciples fast? Why are you doing what's not lawful? So there's all kinds of pushback against the truth claims that Jesus was making. And all of his actions and truth claims were highly contestable, which is something we look for. Number four, in the world of Jesus, there is acknowledgement that the same empirical evidence is capable of being reasonably understood in a variety of ways. Not all of it's a slam dunk by any means. So in Mark 6:14, for example, we have an account of various estimates that people made about who Jesus was. Some thought he was John the Baptist. Some thought he was Elijah, and some thought he was one of the ancient prophets. All based on the same observations of the same empirical evidence. And this variety of interpretations of the same evidence is accounted for by the varying assumptions or presuppositions that people brought to the interpretive task. So Herod too, for example, thought that Jesus was probably John the Baptist come back to life. And he did this out of a guilty conscience, right? He'd been trapped into beheading John. And so this was his frame of reference for interesting people that came along. Maybe John's back here to haunt me. That was his interpretation of this evidence. And Elijah, well, there was a strand of ancient Jewish thinking that said, well, Elijah is available to come back and do more stuff on the planet because, after all, he went to the sky on a fiery chariot without ever dying. He should be available to do special things in the end of the age. So when Jesus comes along, the category they have available is, oh, maybe this is Elijah. And similarly, when they talk about maybe he's a prophet, again, there's a strand of Jewish thinking that said in the end times, a special prophet will come and do various special things and so on. So again, various people have that category available to interpret this piece of empirical evidence. So each of these interpretation is entirely reasonable given the presuppositions of the interpreters. Each interpretation makes sense in a particular worldview, and each fits a particular hypothesis. Interestingly, a similar thing occurs later in Mark chapter 8, and here a fourth option is added to the mix of John and Elijah and the prophet, namely Messiah.
Yeah.
And at this point, as the narrative has shifted on, more evidence has become available, and in the light of added evidence, this is the interpretation that sticks. So this is what happens with empirical research, and so on, and so on. So, number five, in the world of Jesus, there is acknowledgement that some empirical evidence has no adequate explanation, at least no adequate explanation at the time. So in Mark 4:26-29, they have a very interesting story about a man scattering seed on the ground. No mention is made of any fertilizer and cultivating or pruning or anything like that. The man goes about all his regular activities without any further attention to the planted seed. He doesn't do anything at all till harvest, but simply waits. But in the meantime, all kinds of things are going on with that plant. There's sprouting, there's growing, there's a blade, there's a ear, there's a full green, there's a ripening, and so on and so on. All of these things just seem to happen by themselves. These processes are not understood at all, but the farmer still brings in his grain. So the reference seems to be to the fact that human beings can and do and necessarily have to function without explanations of every little piece and every piece of empirical evidence that might be out there. This is how we live. Presumably there's an infinite amount of empirical evidence out there. Human beings live successfully without understanding all of it or even that much of it. And no doubt we'll continue to do so. So there's acknowledgement that some evidence has no adequate explanation. So up to now I've talked about what Jesus and his world thought. And all of this has been fairly compatible with anything that science cares about. I don't see any jarring juxtapositions or any problems there, particularly. And all of this was also in keeping with Jesus' own culture. It's in keeping with our culture. So, so far, so good. Nothing too problematic, I would say. This will change a little bit in my next three points. And I just want you to be aware of that. So I'm going to say, instead of in the world of Jesus, I'll say in the mind of Jesus, just to make it a little more specific to him. So in the number six, in the mind of Jesus, there is encouragement to value a plurality of methods of inquiry, not just inquiry by way of empirical evidence. There's more to thinking and knowing than just empirical evidence. The epistemological interest of Jesus is not limited to empirical evidence alone. There's the interplay of various kinds of inquiry and truth-seeking. It's the systematization of method and the commitment to empirical evidence exclusively that's unique to science. It's not their interest in empirical evidence as such. Everybody cares about empirical evidence. So in several places, Jesus uses pure logic to make his case, just to illustrate this point. Nearing the end of his ministry, Jesus was confronted, how are we doing time? Here we go. Near the end of his ministry, Jesus was confronted with a full range of Jewish officials questioning about the origin of his authority to do what he had been doing. Jesus turned the tables and asked the the officials a question. He said, well, take John's baptism, for example. Was it from God or was it from man? And the officials thought about it and said, well, if we say from heaven, we're in deep trouble, because then Jesus would say, well, why didn't you follow him? And if we say from man, then we're going to have an uprising and a riot and so on and so on. So we can't answer. Okay? There's a beautiful piece of pure logic that Jesus used simply to confound those who were coming against him. Similarly, on another occasion, Mark chapter 3, Jesus confronted by scribes from Jerusalem, claiming that he was casting out demons by the prince of the demons. You remember that one? And Jesus makes the very logical argument that the demons are not going to be fighting with each other, are they? How can the prince cast out the others? What kind of a house is that? What kind of a system is that? That makes no sense at all. And he points out the illogic of their assumption and of their argument. So there's a variety of means of arriving at truth. Jesus also used the historical and documentary evidence. Three times in Mark, he asked the question, have you not read? Yes, have you not read? And each of these is a reference, of course, to the ancient Jewish documentation, which shed light on the particular issue that was at hand. This kind of evidence, historical evidence, was authoritative for him and for his audience, and was a very clear and smart choice to make in answering some of the questions that were there. And of course, it's worth noting that this historical evidence was empirical evidence of an earlier time, but it's only accessible through historical documents and so on, and it certainly was not repeatable. All right, number seven. In the mind of Jesus, there is profound and even disturbing questioning of the human capacity to achieve real and true understanding through observation alone or observation at all. Yeah. So, for example, in Mark 4:1 and following, and other places, Jesus talks to his disciples in a parable, and he says, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. So this is clearly a warning about the fact that both empirical evidence itself, what you hear, and interpretations thereof are not the same as true apprehension or understanding of those things. Yes? Hearing correctly and observing correctly is not just a matter for the ears alone, but it's for the brain. Yeah, this is something that happens in the human brain. There's a vast difference between seeing and truly perceiving. There's a big difference between hearing and understanding. So, you know, modern brain science has confirmed that seeing is not mostly in your eyes, and hearing is not mostly in your ears. It's in your neuroplastic brain. And so even though you're confronted by all kinds of empirical evidence, it's what happens in your brain that's by far the most critical thing to all of it. And so for the understanding of much of reality, the brain's capacity to think, not just digitally, but analogically and parabolically, is the key for understanding of many, many important things. All right, we're good, are we? I'll come to point eight, and this is really fascinating, I think. In the mind of Jesus, empirical evidence was sometimes carefully, deliberately, and imaginatively organized in support of explicitly metaphysical claims. Yeah. So one of the most fascinating accounts of Jesus dealing with the reality of his time is one that's loaded with epistemological freight. In Mark chapter 2, 1 to 12, we have this great story of the paralytic being dropped down through the roof so they can get close to Jesus. And the first thing Jesus says to him is, your sins are forgiven. And we have to be careful we don't follow that red herring of healing and forgiveness here. I don't think that's what this is about. This immediately gives rise on the part of those elite around and raises the question, what's your authority to forgive sins? And interestingly, Jesus puts this beautifully, says, which is easier to say to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven, or to say, rise, take up your bed and walk? So here we have an exquisitely posed question about how to produce empirical evidence to prove Jesus' capacity to forgive sins. But of course, the matter of forgiving sins and having the authority to forgive sins is, as far as I can tell, a purely metaphysical question. It's not a physical question, it's a metaphysical question. Social scientists might be able to invent an experiment, couldn't quite easily, about whether a person feels forgiven, yeah? But this is something quite different about the authority to forgive. And so it's more or less impossible for 21st century people to get their mind into this kind of a problem and to figure this out. And it's impossible, I think, to conceive of a scientific experiment that could test authority to forgive sins. This is metaphysical, it's not physical. And this is not a scientific question in any modern sense, even though it's a question of vital concern to practically all of humanity. Everybody has some dealing with the sins, yeah. So Jesus explicitly concedes here that having a way of knowing who has authority to forgive sins was really the burning question. And so he says, interestingly, take up your bed and walk. So he gives empirical evidence that proves that he has the power to heal. And that's as much as we're going to get. And I think what that says is, that for metaphysical questions, you're not going to get direct empirical evidence. It's going to come some other way. And here, I think he's saying, create the analogy that makes that work for you. Okay? In your world, if you need a hard-nosed empirical evidence, I'll give you some. I'll heal this person. But one thing you should take away from it is that by analogy, perhaps that means I can also forgive sins, right? And you have to think analogically, not just digitally, if I could put it that way. Is zero now? Yes, well, that's perfect. I'm pretty much done. I would like to have some discussion and questions. So, there you go. Did Jesus care about empirical evidence? I think overwhelmingly, yes. But it was not the whole story. And so on. So, what do you think?
I have a question. I always wanted to know more why Jesus not only spoke in parables, but seemingly in paradoxical terms.
Yeah.
He tries to gain his life. The music and sorting out examples like can you hear not just to be peace but to hear the sword. So tell me what are your uses?
Yeah. Well, I think the more obvious one is because of the politics of the situation. If he said certain things about the kingdom of God in a Roman situation, that's going to be a big problem, of course. But I think beyond that, there is a concern to drive people to deeper levels of understanding and to understanding what's beyond the physical, not just the physical. So I think it's an effort to. It's those two things, the politics of Rome and the other things.
So you use figures of speech effectively.
Yeah.
Using metaphors.
Exactly. And I think the challenge to 21st century people who are enthralled with science, and I love science too, don't get me wrong, there are other ways of thinking, analogically, parabolically, and so on and so on. It's not all about digital.
Another question?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought it was quite a nice presentation, but one thing that a person might ask would be, did Buddha
care about empirical evidence? Did Confucius care? Yeah. So what I want, or so are you saying that perhaps Jesus and within the Judeo-Christian tradition there was a greater concern for empirical evidence than within other religious traditions? Would you care to talk or speculate about that?
I would, yeah. I think Buddha, in the life he lived, you know, bumped into gravity just like everybody else bumps into gravity. So you have to deal with empirical evidence on a daily basis. So it's not a systematized thing. It's just something that everybody has to get used to. But in terms of his religion or Buddhism, I think it's more mystical and more rational than it is so much about empirical evidence. But I do think that the Jewish and Christian faith are particularly rooted in history, and that's what makes it difficult as well as wonderful.
So you say there is some element of uniqueness, I guess.
Yeah.
We do have to wrap up this session.
Okay.
So
thanks very much.
Thank you very much. And,